Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can robots teach us about biology? While autonomous machines might seem to have little relationship to the processes by which living creatures have evolved on Earth, scientists in recent years have realized that designing robots that mimic real-life organisms helps them to better understand how nature itself works. My guest today is a leader in that field. John Long is professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College, where he is also chair of the Department of Biology and director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory. His new book is called Darwin's Devices: What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. John, welcome to Think.
Well, hello, Chris. Thank you for having me.
What is biorobotics?
Well, biorobotics is just as you described. I mean, you did it beautifully, which is to try to understand animals by building robots that mimic them.
So how did that idea emerge, that we could learn about biology by creating machines that mimic certain processes of life and evolution? Because obviously you're not going to create something that is nearly as complex as a biological organism.
Well, that's right. And I think the way it emerged is biologists got frustrated. And that's because you can only do certain kinds of things with animals because they either won't behave for you, or in the case of fossils, they're not there to behave, right? So dead fossils tell no tales. So how do you recover the behavior that comes about from living forms? And so the original work that was done about a decade ago was done by some behavioral biologists who were trying to figure out the mechanisms that animals used to do things like orient to sound, how crickets moved and turned during their mating calls. And that really led to what we've been doing, which is using biorobotics to understand evolutionary process, what goes on over millions of years.
So explain for us, for people who might be saying, well, that sounds more like intelligent design than evolution, how exactly does the process work in the lab and with people who are designing these things?
Yeah, well, one of the things that goes on with evolution is that it takes place from generation to generation. Unfortunately for all of us as individuals, we don't evolve, right? It's the populations that we're in that evolve. And so what's really key to understanding evolution as a process is that animals are, and plants and microorganisms are all variable, and it's meaning they behave differently, they look differently, and because we're variable, we have different ways of succeeding in what I call the game of life, and that is making a living, surviving, and reproducing. And so we don't know from any generation to the next what's going to be the successful design, and that's why it's not intelligent design, because the environment is always changing. Evolution is tracking one generation behind those evolutionary changes. So because we understand that process of natural selection, we understand what's happening genetically with mutation, providing those variations, then we can actually simulate that in our robots in our laboratory by building a population of variable robots and then causing them to play the game of life in front of us using autonomous behavior.
So talk about why actually putting these things into a physical environment works better than, there's some really sophisticated computer programs that would seem to be able to simulate the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. And we actually do computer programs and we do embodied robots. And one of the great things about doing the embodied robots is you get the physics for free. You don't have to model the physics. And when we do a computer program, we actually have to turn the physical interactions, all that really difficult mathematics, has to be put into equations. And so when we actually build our computer simulations, we have to take care to validate those computer simulations with either the animals or the robots. And it turns out that the particular world in which I work, which is the world of aquatic vertebrates, things swimming around in the ocean, is really tricky to measure physically and to simulate physically. So far, our robotic simulations are actually more accurate than our computer simulations.
What made you decide to focus on mechanical fish?
I love fish. I love eating them. I love watching them. I love scuba diving. And so that's the fun part of it for me. And also, the fun about being a biologist is I get to ask questions that drive me crazy, like, what happened 500 million years ago at the origin of this group of animals that we belong to called vertebrates? And we have a very spotty fossil record, So we just have some snapshots of what the animals were like 500 million years ago. And so I get to ask, jeepers, the first vertebrates were fish. And they were fish with this crazy structure called a backbone. And a backbone is a series of vertebrae, and we all have these vertebrae. They drive us crazy in our lumbar and our cervical spines and so forth. And early on in the history of vertebrates, they didn't have those bones in the back. So even though as a group we're called vertebrates because of these vertebrae, ironically, we didn't have those bones when vertebrates first evolved. And so I want to say, hey, you know, why is this? What's going on with this early evolution? And so I look at the fossil record, I see what we know about the pattern, and then we use evolutionary biorobotics to uncover the processes that may have occurred to drive these changes in these early vertebrates.
Tell us a little bit more about this process called reverse engineering, where you take what you know now and then you go backward to build something that resembles it.
Well, reverse engineering is a good way to think about it, where we use the principles of design, and I mean mechanical design here, not intelligent design, that we have about the workings of cars and airplanes and submarines, so that engineers have developed, and we use those engineering principles to then understand how life forms are built to do the jobs that they do. And so a lot of what we do then is to find the appropriate mechanical principles that govern the physical interaction of whatever kind of animal we're interested in with its world. And so when we're building our robots, what we do is we actually look back, let's say, 500 million years ago to the first vertebrate fishes that were out there swimming around, and we say, okay, what's it like to be a swimmer? And we know a lot about swimming from work on the work that we and other folks have done on living fishes, and so we know something about the physics that are involved, and we can say, you know what, if you're going to swim faster or you're going to accelerate faster, here's what we need to look at. We need to look at the stiffness of the body. We need to look at the size of the tail, because we know that the engineering principles tell us the bigger your propeller, the faster you're going to go. And so that's how we use those engineering principles to make guesses initially about what was important 500 million years ago, and then design robots that vary the structures that we think are important so that we, in our laboratory, evolution can occur.
So you had to mess around not only with the different sort of iterations of developing vertebrae in these animals, but you also had to think about what materials to use, and that proved to be a challenge.
Absolutely, and that's a field called biomimetic engineering. So the mimesis in the word biomimetic is from mimic. And so what we do is we use approaches called biomechanical approaches to study what we can in living animals, and so we have We mess around with sharks, too, in our laboratory. And so we study how sharks swim. We study how their vertebral columns are built, and we can measure the mechanical properties, the stiffness and energy loss of their vertebral columns very closely and accurately. And then we use that information to design biomimetic vertebral columns that we're then going to put into our robots. And so the trick of biomimetics is to be able to mimic life, and life is flexible and wet, mm-hmm. as opposed to what engineers make, which tends to be dry and hard.
Right.
Yeah, so it's that process of working with wet stuff that's really tricky. So when we actually build these biomimetic structures, we have to do this crazy stuff like we always have to keep them wet. You know, there's no time when you say, okay, you can walk away and leave it on the countertop. You actually have to put it into a chamber to keep it wet and ready to go when you're ready to put it into your robot. So that process of biomimetics right now is a really interesting one in engineering, where engineers are reaching into the world of biology for new kinds of materials, new kinds of designs when they build robots and other kinds of structures.
So describe a TADRO and what it looks like and how it functions.
Sure. Yeah, a TADRO, the name comes from tadpole robot, mm-hmm. and these are some of what we call evolvabots. So these are these biorobots that are built to mimic particular kinds of species, but we call them evolvabots because they're also built in a population of these TADROs in order to evolve using selection and mutation. And so I'm going to tell you a trade secret here. The trade secret is they're swimming Tupperware. So that's why they look like a sort of tadpole, is they've got this bowl, and inside the bowl that's floating on the surface of the water sits a computer. That computer takes sensory input from eyes and a very specialized structure that fish have called a lateral line, and that computer is programmed to act like the brain of a fish and make decisions about what to do with the sensory information that it's got. And those decisions have to do with, how do I turn my tail? How rapidly do I flap? And so what we do with the tadro as it's swimming around on the surface of the water, gathering information, is we stand back and watch this autonomous, hands-off behavior. So when we build the tadros to be a population of six individuals, we also throw in a predator into our tank that's in our laboratory. This is a predatory robot whose only job is to try to attack the tadros. And we then do what is sort of evolutionary Olympics, which is we judge the individuals and we rank them and we allow the top three in our population to be the ones that have their genome, their genetic information represented in the next generation.
John Long is my guest. He's professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College and director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory there. His new book is called Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. We'll come back to our conversation with John in just a few minutes, and you can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also ask a question via email to think@kera.org. If you would like to receive a copy of this fascinating book, Darwin's Devices, we do have it available today as a thank you gift when you make a contribution to the station at or above $120. You can do that online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is in studio now, senior producer of Think, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. We are closing in on we've actually passed a really significant milestone in the membership campaign. We're under $200,000 left to raise, about $198,000 in change to end this membership campaign successfully with your call at 888-694-6931. Of course, that means we have a goal for this hour of Think, Chris. It's $7,000. We need to raise $7,000 by 1 p.m. to help KERA end this campaign as soon as possible. So be the next one to call, 1-888-694-6931, or go online to kera.org. And for a $120 contribution, we'll happily thank you with your very own copy of Professor John Long's new book, Darwin's Devices.
We know you don't make contributions to the station just for the thank you gifts, but I have to tell you, this is a fascinating book, very fun to read. It's accessible, but it's also, I think, would be interesting for the engineer or the scientist or just the science buff in your life. You can receive your copy at 1-888-694-6931 or make an online contribution at kera.org. This show is able to bring you wonderful gifts. Guests and a great variety of guests, in part because you're just interested. We know that you love this sort of thing, that a guest like John Long gets you excited. You want to call in and ask questions. You want to contribute to the program. Your financial contributions are also vital because we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be able to produce a local program if not for the support of people who listen every single day. 1-888-694-6931.
We have a goal of $7,000 to raise this hour, during this hour of Think Today. $6,905 remaining in that goal. So we've heard from maybe a couple of you, maybe one of you. How about you? Call us, 888-694-6931, or go to kera.org and make your contribution. Please don't wait. Please do it now, because the sooner you go ahead and make your contribution, the sooner this membership campaign will come to a successful conclusion.
We know that you as an audience are not going anywhere. You're going to continue listening to the program. Don't you want to make sure that it is here and vital and strong and continues to serve you? Your money makes it happen. KERA.org is the place to go to make a tax-deductible contribution. Or you can do this over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Again, the thank you gift for this hour, among the thank you gifts, is John Long's new book, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. We've got yours waiting when you make a contribution now online at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Long, professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College, also chair of the Department of Biology and director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory at Vassar. His new book is called Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, before we talk more about what you learned with these Tadros, talk a little bit about why it's so important to get the name right.
Well, you know, I don't know of a robot that doesn't have a stupid name. So it's a very important part. It's the art of the science behind mm-hmm. robotics, actually. And you really want to name your robot, because if you don't, somebody else will. And let me just tell you about my favorite robot that's come out of our lab, Robot Madeline.
Mm-hmm.
And I named her Robot Madeline because she looked like the French pastry called a Petite Madeleine. And the reason I didn't want to name her Robo Turtle, which is what the press named her, mm-hmm. In spite of my complaints, was that she wasn't built to be a turtle. She was built to be any sort of four-flippered vertebrate that had a history being on the land and then went back into the water. So we can use Madeline to understand the outcome of evolution, say, to look at plesiosaurs, which were these giant 30-foot-long critters like Loch Ness swimming around during the time of the dinosaurs in the seas. We can look at them to study turtles for sure. With Madeline, we can also use Madeline to study how sea lions might swim. So Madeline is a name that didn't really stick when it came to naming a robot. So we've already talked about the Tadros, so there's a common way to take two words and smush them together. And then you can do things like acronyms to try to understand or make it ununderstandable for your audience so that they have to query you about, well, what does VCHUC stand for? And you can say, well, it's vorticity control underwater unmanned vehicle, as one robot that's also known as Robotuna is sometimes called. So naming is really important to make you feel like you're a true nerd, I think, is what it comes down to.
You know, the other thing that's really interesting about this, John, is not only do you have to communicate, or as a scientist, you, like many in your profession, feel an obligation to communicate all of this research to regular people who are listening, those of us listening on the radio, those of us who will read the book. You've also got to make all this clear to people who might give you the funding to get this done.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's critical. And we've been really lucky about getting funding from the National Science Foundation, the Office of Naval Research, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and all of those different agencies, which all use taxpayer money, by the way, have different missions that they're trying to accomplish. So each one of those funding agencies wants something different out of the researchers. And one of the really interesting things about working with robotic fishes is a lot of these places right now really love robotic fish, in part because engineers are interested in them and military is interested in robotic fish, because they rightly, in part, believe that fish do things that our machines don't currently do. For example, swim with very small amounts of energy, so swim very energy efficiently, swim with a lot of stealth, so they can be very quiet, and they can also be highly maneuverable, so they can get into places where our normal underwater vehicles can't get.
So should we be nervous about this research?
Some of it. I say nervous. You know, I don't think anybody's going to be delivering nuclear warheads with a robotic fish. But, hey, I'm not in the military. I don't actually know what everybody's planning there. But here's what I know for sure. Of the kinds of projects that are being funded right now, most of them have an explicit underwater exploration purpose to them, meaning, you know, we know less about the bottom of the ocean than we do about the surface of the moon.
Yeah.
When we have oil spills, we want our robots to go help us out and learn about oil spills, the extent to which they've spread. We want our robots, as we saw with the Deepwater Horizon disaster, we want our robots down there being our eyes and ears and our hands. So robots really expand our presence in the water, and they really expand our capabilities when we make them as fish underwater. So most of the work that's being done, I don't get nervous about. And then there's the stuff you don't know about, which are really the top secret military applications. And I don't have any special clearance or anything like that, but I can tell you that robots are being developed for warfare, and these are robots in the air that we call drones, robots on land and robots in the water, in over 50 countries.
Hmm. So let's get back to the Tadros for a minute. You mentioned earlier that you gave them the task of avoiding a predator. Another really important thing that organisms have to do is find a food source. So how are you going to, obviously a robot doesn't eat, so what sort of task would approximate that?
Yeah, what we did here is take advantage of biology again and recognize that light is life for biology. It all starts with sunlight that allows plants, and even little plants that are in the water, to create sugar, glucose, using that energy from the sun. And so what our robots do, our Tadros do, is their first job is to eat. And so we have a light source that's in our tank, and these robots are out there hunting for the light source. I'm a donut lover, so I can't help but think about, you know, you go to that office meeting, right, and you first thing you do is scan around and you look for the table of donuts. And then you want to get to that table quickly so you can get the chocolate donut, which is the only donut worth eating, I believe. and so you want to get that chocolate donut. And then if depending on how hungry you are, maybe you want to hang out around that table.
Mm-hmm.
And so our Tadros are doing the equivalent of that. They're looking for the donut table, the light source. They swim quickly towards it. And then they get rewarded in the game of life that we judge, which is how we do the evolution. They get rewarded for getting there quickly, hanging around the light source. And then in addition, if there's a predator that's interested in them as a food, getting the heck out of the way from the predator. So we really combine two different tasks. One is feeding, and the other one is fleeing from a predator.
And as in natural evolution, there have been experiments in which a physical characteristic that would have appeared to be counterproductive has a serendipitous benefit. For example, a wobble that at first glance would just seem to cost energy.
That's absolutely right. And this is where you brought up reverse engineering in the previous segment. And that's where reverse engineering can only take you so far. We may understand the physical principles. We may be able to write those physical principles down in equations. But until we actually see how the animal or the biorobot is behaving on its own, not remote control, just doing its own thing in the game of life, we don't know for sure what the function of any particular trait is. And so when we were judging a group of Tadros called Tadro 3 that were involved just in how well can you feed, we were punishing them if they wobbled a lot. And the wobble is, as they were wiggling their tails, how much did their head go back and forth?
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine when you're running, I don't know if you're a runner or when you walk around, you know, if you flap your arms and you're all over the place, that takes a lot more energy to do compared to a really compact way of holding your arms as you're doing your training for a marathon.
Harder to get to my donut, certainly, yes.
Absolutely. And or you can use your donuts as a reward for your training. You know, donuts are very, you know, undervalued motivational tactic for many of us. So anyway, that these Tadro 3s were being rewarded for getting to the light source quickly, the food quickly, but doing it in a very efficient way. And what we found out is that after we did the evolution, and we were looking at how behavior changed over evolutionary time, we said, wait a minute, yeah, these guys are getting faster, but they're also getting more wobbly. Mm-hmm. And that really caused us to say, wait a minute, is wobble really bad? And so we did a separate series of experiments where we tested them just swimming straight, without having to behave in the sense of finding food or compete with other individuals. And what we found is when we did those tests is that, sure enough, wobble was bad. But it was much lower amount of wobble than we saw in the actual behavioral realm of the evolutionary experiment. So here's where the simulations actually help us out that we do on computer. So then we did computer simulations, and what we found is that when a robot executes a turn, which you need to do to come back to the donut table or come back to the light or to avoid a predator,
mm-hmm.
when you execute that turn, that shows up as a really big wobble. And that was the surprise. We said, oh, that's really cool. We didn't mean to measure maneuverability, but that's what we're picking up here, is we're measuring how maneuverable they are, and that's why it's correlated with increased speed, is because the faster you go, the more jerky or the more rapid your turn can be.
I love talking with scientists because so often, instead of being really depressed when something doesn't go as you expected, you get excited.
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you that in the moment when you realize that, oh, my goodness, this didn't go as planned, that we were excited about it. But I can't tell you that's what happens. And actually, I say something to my students who've been really important in all this research that drives them nuts. I say, you know, we're going to fail our way to success here. Hmm. And part of that is when we're doing something like helping create this new field of biology called evolutionary biorobotics, there's no textbook out on this. There's no owner's manual for these robots. We're building these robots from scratch. We're addressing questions in a way that have never, in ways that have never been done before. So if we're not failing, as my undergraduate advisor said, then we're not trying hard enough, right?
Continue, please.
Yeah, so anyway, just back to your point about, you know, the fact that we have these surprises and these failures. So I try to destigmatize failure, to put it into passive voice, mm-hmm. for the students and say, you know what, so let's just work together and design good experiments. And when you design a good experiment, no matter what the outcome of that experiment is, you're going to learn something, even if it's not what you thought you were going to learn. But that's why you run the experiments.
John Long is with us. He's professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College, where he's also chair of the Department of Biology and director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory. We're speaking this hour about his new book, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll come back to our conversation with John Long in a few minutes. You can read a copy of his book when you make a contribution to the station at the level of $120 or more. The book is called Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. You can secure your copy and secure another great year of radio programming and of this show specifically by going online now to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Hello again, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank John Ambler in Fort Worth for making a contribution. Also want to thank an anonymous donor who made a contribution in honor of Carolyn Horchow.
Very nice.
Want to thank everyone who's contributed today. Our goal for the hour, $7,000. What this does, this keeps us on track to finish this drive as soon as possible. It gets us really within striking distance of finishing the drive very soon. And we've raised part of that so far, but Chris, we're still looking for $6,750 during this first hour of Think Today. Your call right now to 888-694-6931. Your online contribution at kera.org will help us get there.
Phone lines are filling up now with folks who want to speak with John Long, and I'm not surprised. He's a great guest. You know, if you are someone who likes to interact with the show, if you never miss the show, recognize that there's a cost even to something as simple as having a call-in program. You know, there's another staff member who's required to take those calls and to set them up. There's a whole system of equipment that is required. Your contribution allows us to continue providing this service to you in the way you've become accustomed. We know so many of you love, love, love the podcast. You know, the hours that the show is on, noon to 2 and 9 to 11, you may not be able to listen live, but a growing number of you catch the show at your own time. That is available because a few years ago, we put this in place thanks to contributions from folks like you, and your contributions pay the ongoing cost of packaging and preparing and distributing the podcast.
888-694-6931 is where you can call to help offset those costs or go online to kera.org. I want to thank Carolyn Mentisana in Arlington, Grit Bros in Carrollton, Daniel Withheiler in Dallas, and Stephen Carton in Fort Worth. We'd love to thank you. $6,750 left to raise this hour to stay on track to end the drive as soon as possible.
Public radio is a service that exists because all of us who listen to public radio think it should be around, because we know it's not like anything else on the broadcast aisle, certainly not in this market. You can't hear an hour-long discussion about evolving robots anywhere else in this market. You might hear a minute and a half, followed by 3.5 minutes of commercial somewhere. from, but you can't have a lengthy conversation. You can't interact with a scientist at the forefront of this work. This is the programming that your contributions put out there and create for you and for the entire community. You can take part in making Think happen by calling 1-888-694-6931 or going online to make a contribution at kera.org. Give $120 or more, and you might want to pick up a copy of Darwin's Devices by John Long.
Yeah, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology is available. When you join the station as a member at the $120 membership level or greater, $120, that's a significant contribution, but you should know that it's actually about the average contribution of your fellow listeners who decide to support the station, and you can budget it very easily by becoming a sustaining member. You can set it up so it's $10 a month out of your bank account or $10 a month on your debit or credit card, and it's automatic. You can set it, and then you don't have to worry about it. You know that your membership is always current, and you'll get your very own copy of the book. Of course, the book is out. It's been out, I think it's been out for a few weeks, and it's available for you anywhere, but we hope that you will thank KERA for bringing this conversation, bringing this to your attention with a contribution today. The number to call to do that, it's 888-694-6931, or go to kera.org and make a contribution there. Again, still looking for $6,750 to make our goal this hour. It's really important that we meet these goals, especially as we enter the final phase of the drive, because we all want to wrap up this campaign as quickly as possible.
It would be terrific to hear from a couple of friends this hour. Friends are people who give at or above $1,500 a year. I'll tell you something that's interesting. We have these special friends events for people who give at that level, and they get together and meet with NPR celebrities and other people. Some of these folks are, I'm not going to drop any names, but they are well-known philanthropists throughout North Texas, in Dallas and Fort Worth and Denton. Some of the friends are just regular people who believe that public radio really matters. And for them, maybe this is their only major philanthropic contribution, but it's a service that they use, something they believe in, and something that reflects their values of civil discourse and the exploration in an intelligent way of every topic under the sun.
888-694-6931. You can make your friend's contribution there. You can go online to kera.org and do it. You can set it up as a sustaining membership for just $125 a month in support of your public radio station. You're gonna feel great when you join the station. You're going to feel great when you finally support it. The number to call, 888-694-6931. Or go to kera.org.
A great deal of people who contribute to the station for the first time come back year after year. If you meet one of those folks, ask them. Obviously, they really like contributing to KERA. It makes them feel great. It's something they want to continue doing. Why don't you try it now for the first time? See how great it feels to really be part of the team that makes public radio possible. 1-888-694-6931, kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Long, director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory at Vassar College and author of the new book Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, John, we humans like to ruminate on our giant brains that allow us to invent movable type and listen to public radio and get PhDs in cognitive science. One of the remarkable things that you have discovered through your research is that in terms of intelligent behavior in the field, in real life, brains are not the only story.
Oh, absolutely. And that was a big surprise that we got from this research on evolving robots, is we didn't evolve the brain, and yet our fish-like robots got smarter in terms of finding food and avoiding predators. And what this boils down to is, okay, so what evolved over generational time? And that was the body evolved. So part of what we think about as our intelligence is really part of our body.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Alex in Red Oak. Hey, Alex.
Hey there. How are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good, thank you.
I'm 17 years old. I just wanted to say I think this is really awesome. Just wanted to let you know. My question is, what has your research shown about the evolution of intelligence, especially of the caliber that we humans have?
Well, Alex, it's a great question. In my lab, we don't work on humanoid robots at all, but you could certainly use this approach, evolutionary biorobotics, to test questions about human-level intelligence. And again, thinking about the fact that our brain is not the only thing that's involved with being intelligent, it also includes the body. One of the things that I think is really interesting about human evolutionary history is this huge locomotor transition that our species went through to become a biped, a walking, high-endurance kind of animal. And that's a job for you, Alex, is to figure out a way to build your bipedal robots and test that idea about how intelligence is linked with standing upright, freeing your hands for use of tools and things like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Philip on the line in Dallas. Hey, Philip.
Good afternoon. I wanted to make a comment about the statement about failing in order to succeed. Thomas Edison was once asked about his experiments and about the number of failures that he had, and he was not known for his scientific approach to research. But anyway, Edison supposedly spat on the floor and answered back, and he said, "Failures? I've never had a failure. I just know thousands of things that don't work." And I thought that would be of interest.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's great, Philip. And I think, you know, Edison is a real model for all of us. I mean, how many different filaments did he try before he found the one that worked? He and his collaborators, by the way, found the one that worked. I think it was up in the thousands.
Talk a little bit about motivation. You've spoken about speaking to your students about the reality that they're going to have to go back to the drawing board over and over. Is there a certain type of personality that can really persist with this kind of research?
Yeah, and it's not the kind you would think. I mean, in many ways, the best scientists are not the lightning in the sky flash of brilliant idea. It's the folks who can plod along on a daily basis and get back up, you know, and on the horse and try riding again. And that's not what you see on TV when you watch a sitcom about nerdy physicists, for example. But it's really true that there's something really important about being somebody who's willing to give something multiple tries. And I think this is really key, you've got to be willing to have fun and find ways to have fun when you're innovating, right? Because the scientific enterprise that I'm talking about doing this research is, it's, as Philip was just pointing out, is its own kind of innovation process.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have fun, you engage all sorts of intelligences that you have. You do things that you wouldn't normally do just because maybe you're goofing around a little bit, or maybe you're making a joke, and the next thing you know, you're on to something new. So creating a collaborative environment in the laboratory is really key. And so I actually look for students who are able to have fun. And I'm lucky to be at Vassar, where most of our students are really intelligent, so that's not a problem. But then what I'm looking for is people who work together, have fun as a team. And another thing that happens when you're having fun is when things do fail, you say, "Oh, okay, well, that's too bad that robot didn't work, but that's okay. I'm having fun doing this process, so I'll keep plodding along having fun with my friends in the lab."
Well, we really get that sense from the book, and for people who haven't been able to pick up on this just listening to you, there's a great deal of humor in the book itself.
Well, I'm glad you think about it that way, because my serious science friends say, "Oh, it's a rather chatty book you've written." And, you know, this is not a book written for academics.
Right.
It's really a book written for, as I like to think about it, fun-loving nerds who want to learn something cool about science.
You've come to the right place.
Yes, where you think.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next on the phone with Joe in Arlington. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I just wanted to know if your guest would speak on his thoughts and opinions on whether one day we as humans will be able to transcend our biology into technology. I know I've seen something about that on Netflix where the scientist was talking about his thoughts on that, but I just want to know if your guest had any thoughts on that too. And I'll bring my answer out the air.
Sure.
Joe, I think we're already there in many ways. You know, we have so many pieces of technology that we now take for granted that are embedded in our electronics, our appliances, our cars, that really extend our human capabilities. The biomedical realm is one area, too, with devices that we get implanted, devices that we use for implantation in medicine as well. So I think humans are really excellent at avoiding the scary Hollywood trope of robots taking over, and yet, in fact, robots are taking over, or embedded intelligence are taking over. They can fly our planes now. They can drive our boats. They can basically do everything we need to do on cars, as you know, from maybe the Google cars, or if you happen to be a Lexus owner, you know, your Lexus will do a lot for you on the highway, or it'll parallel park, as well as your Ford Focus will do that. You know, so we are willingly enabling our machines to be intelligent, to take on tasks that we would rather have them do than do ourselves.
This is quite a non sequitur, but I'm really interested in getting to this. What did you learn about why, for example, aquatic mammals don't use four flippers, even though they are descended from animals that had four legs?
Yeah, and this is one of the great things about using these biorobots to try to study evolution. Even if we're not interested, for example, in how you got from point A to point B on the evolutionary map, we can send in these what we call evolutionary trekkers to look at the outcomes of evolution. And so, for example, exactly what you're talking about, this is one of those sort of, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and you go, why if four flippers were good 60, 70 million years ago, aren't four flippers good now? And let me just draw a contrast for you. Sea turtles, which are in their own way very successful species, swim with their front limbs and they push them up and down, and they use what's called a lift-based kind of propulsive mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Sea lions do a very similar thing. Seals, true seals, they actually use their rear flippers. But none of these guys use all four to be cruising around. So that's where I go, okay, you know, wait a minute. Plesiosaurs ruled the planet, or ruled the oceans, back in the Mesozoic era. So why don't we see plesiosaur-like critters now? And this is always... biology, or any historical science, really, is full of these counterfactuals. What if? Why didn't it occur this way? And so we can go back with our biorobots and really explore the what ifs. And what we learned is that four flippers swimming propulsively, generating thrust with all four flippers, is actually great for accelerating from a stop. And here's where the surprise came in. Once you get to a top speed, though, you don't go any faster with four flippers than you do with two. So there's a trade-off. If evolution is selecting for individuals that are better at accelerating, then we would expect to see four-flippered critters. If evolution is selecting for individuals that are better at cruising and doing so efficiently, then we would expect the two-flippered critters. So this is a great example, using the robot that we call Robot Madeline. This is a great example of where building a robot as a model of different kinds of organisms can actually tell us something about the biology.
What's the most recent question that woke you up in the middle of the night that you now want to explore?
We're working on something right now in the laboratory that is involved with swarm intelligence. And you may have heard about this. Groups of a small, simple robots operating together, or even large and complicated robots operating together. So you think of a school of fish or a flock of geese or any kind of coordinated behavior,
yeah,
among individuals. And what we have found so far is that you actually don't need to communicate with other individuals to get what looks like intelligent behavior out of that group.
Hmm.
So, you know, this is related to flocking and all these kinds of behaviors that we see with groups of organisms. And we find that the simple process of sharing a common goal can coordinate your behavior.
Well, come back and talk about that when you're done with the research, will you?
I will.
John Long is professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College. His new book is called Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. John, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, it's a great program you have. I feel really honored to be on it, so thank you.
Thank you all who were listening this hour and who participated in the show as callers, as emailers. Thanks especially to those of you who have participated in this fundraising campaign as supporting members of the station. KERA relies on money from people who listen to the station. That means you, to make contributions in order to keep us strong and healthy and allow us to serve you. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number for you to join this esteemed group of listeners. You can also become a member of the station online at kera.org. And if you would like to read John Long's book, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology, that's available today with a contribution at or above $120. And you can do that right now. Hey, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris Boyd. Call 888-694-6931. I think we crossed the line today.
Too interesting.
Into the too interesting guest for the pledge drive, because we haven't heard from a whole lot of people during this hour. Still $6,630 left to raise by 1 o'clock, really by 1:01, of our $7,000 goal. That means just $370 came in. I'm really shocked because what a great conversation. And you certainly, if you're into this kind of thing, you want to read Professor John Long's book. You want to check out his lab's webpage. If you go to the Think page and click on his name, it'll take you to his lab. It's pretty fascinating stuff that he's doing. We were thrilled to have this conversation and share it with you today. We're hoping that you'll support it by calling 888-694-6931 or by clicking and contributing online at kera.org.
$5,655 left to go to make the goal. Let's let folks know we really want to finish this campaign. We have some really interesting guests coming up in the next few days. Mm-hmm. We have Mark Bittman in studio on Thursday. Is that right?
That's right.
On the following Tuesday, rather, we have John Irving coming
tomorrow. We have H.W. Brands.
Tomorrow we have H.W. Brands, of course. He's got a great new book out about Aaron Burr, a really interesting take on his personal life. We love to be able to give you the full hour of content, the full conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We will be able to do it with your support. When you make your contribution, we will be done with the drive from your perspective, and that will be added to all the contributions from everybody else across North Texas. It really does take thousands of listeners to come together, make contributions, and keep the station healthy. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to do your part, or you can become a member online at kera.org.
And Chris, I think one of the reasons, and we've talked about this even during a membership break before, I think one of the reasons it's so challenging is because you consume this programming as an individual. So it's us and it's you. And that's how you listen. That's how I listen. I mean, I'm in my kitchen tinkering around making coffee in the morning, or maybe I'm even working in the garage on a project or doing some sort of chicken coop repair. And I may have the KERA app streaming into my headphones while I'm doing that. And it's just me and, you know, Ira Glass and whoever's contributing, or me and the Car Talk guys, or me and Morning Edition. Well, if we took you and the other, I don't know, 350 to 400,000 people who are listening and put you in a big, huge stadium together, then you could look around and say, wow, I'm part of this huge group. And then when we said, hey, will you please stand up if you will give some money to support the station? Many of you would stand up immediately, and then many more of you would go, oh, of course I'm going to stand up.
I'm not going to let the guy next to me pay my share.
Right. Of course I'm going to stand up and support KERA. I love KERA. And look at all the people that I'm joining when I join and support a KERA. Well, we can't do that. We're stuck with a situation where you listen to us as an individual. So our best hope is to convince you that, and it's really true, it does take thousands of people every drive to make it a success. We're just asking you to be one of those people. And trust me, there are hundreds and hundreds of other people who you will be joining when you call 888-694-6931. We're not asking you to do it alone. When you go online to kera.org, you will not be alone.
It has occurred to me, Jeff, that if we were talking to you about this service, if you hadn't yet accessed it, but we told you about the amazing programming you get, about shows like Morning Edition, about shows like The Diane Rehm Show, shows like Think, shows like anything you ever wanted to know that you hear every Friday, you would think, sign me up. Yeah, here's my $50, my $120, my $1,500. I want in on this service. And you wouldn't hesitate to join, to sort of buy this. But because it's already here, it's really easy to take it for granted, in the same way that my children take having meals prepared and cooked and purchased and cleaned up for them for granted, because it's always been there.
Well, don't be like Chris's children.
They're lovely. They really
be
are.
Be good citizens.
They will.
Chris Boyd, host of KERA's Thinks.
Sort of children. Like the fundraising drive. If you ask them enough times, they will pitch in. Just takes a few.
Just takes 5 years. And, 5 years of listening to Mom and 5 years of listening to us tell you how it works. This is how it works. And, we know that these drives can seem a little long, and we know that they can seem at times a little tedious. We're not going to pretend like that's not the case for some of you, but it's really something we wouldn't trade, because it's our best opportunity to tell you the public radio story. And it's a good story. It has a happy ending when we reach the end of the membership campaigns, and hopefully at the end of the day when you look back on what you've heard and what you've learned by listening to KERA. And hopefully when you think about that and reflect on that for just a minute, you'll decide it's worth a little bit of financial support.
You're part of the story of public radio. Think about that. You are part of the story as a listener. You are really a critical part of the story. You become a main character when you make a contribution at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. At last check, we had $5,655 left to raise in this hour. Your contribution now in any amount would really help us out. Friends level membership would be terrific to receive, but do what you can. Maybe you can be a Friends member. Maybe you can be a $5 or $10 or $20 a month member. Whatever works for you. 1-888-694-6931 or online, KERA.org. Thanks.